This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. It has been 40 years since the birth of house music, and we've been celebrating. House is a genre that was born right here in Chicago. Its mama is disco, and it's been overlooked in the popular music scene for decades, until an artist named Beyoncé released her house-inspired album in 2022.
Nobody in the mainstream was talking about house music before Renaissance. I'm so sorry to...
This is DJ Lady D. She's a celebrated DJ and producer whose work spans decades. She was recently named Best House Music DJ in Chicago by the Chicago Reader. I talked to her earlier this year about her work on the House Music 40th Anniversary Planning Committee right before Wicker Park Fest. She was the perfect person to talk to about the roots of house here in Chicago and some of the misconceptions about the music. DJ Lady D, welcome to The Rundown.
Thank you, Erin. It's nice to be here.
Yes. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Washington Heights.
I did.
Tell me about your childhood. What were you into?
Everything, but especially music.
Okay.
I was really drawn to music. My brothers, who are much older than me, like 11 and 16 years older
than me. Oh, my goodness.
Were DJs. Yeah. And so they had a lot of equipment. Techniques, Pioneer, Sony, compressors, you know, tuners, all of that stuff.
Oh.
Some of my earliest memories are just, you know, putting the needle on the record, watching the record spin, looking at the grooves, what's this area, you know, the runoff. I was just really fascinated by it all and not intimidated by it. And so I just watched them, I observed them, and then just mimicked them.
Yeah.
And you know, they didn't think it was wise to have this little girl playing with
their stuff. Yeah, I was going to ask, like, you're their little sister.
Right,
yeah.
Little sister. But I would say that I was so attuned to it that they couldn't stop me. Like, they would leave and they would pull out the plugs, you know, and hide the needles and things. I would find everything, put it back together so I could do my thing. So, yeah, I was always into music.
I heard one of your favorite genres as a kid was disco.
Ooh.
Who were some of your favorite artists?
Okay, obviously Donna Summer.
Okay.
Obviously Diana Ross. I said upside down, you're turning me. You're giving love instinctively. But also Thelma Houston and Teddy Pendergrass. I liked Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Anything soulful, anything funky, the Barqués, GQ, Heatwave. I mean, I could go on. Even the Jacksons, you know, when they did their disco thing. So it's, I could go on and on.
Oh, the Jacksons.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. When you were 10, there was a very infamous event in Chicago that happened, the disco demolition. Bunch of disco haters got together and wrecked the event, which was supposed to be a somewhat lighthearted series of baseball games, right?
Sure.
Fans stormed out onto the field in the thousands. Disco records were hurled like frisbees. Bonfires were set. Bottles were thrown. The batting cage was torn down and destroyed. Fistfights broke out. White Sox players had to be locked in their clubhouse for their own protection.
You later contributed to a book about the incident. If you could just take your mind back to, you know, that time when it was happening and all the fallout from that, what were you thinking about the way disco was being talked about around that time?
I used to spend time with my dad. He used to always make me watch the news with him at the end of the day. And when that happened, we sat together watching the news, watching these clips of, you know, a riot on a baseball field, essentially. And it felt dangerous. It did not feel peaceful or fun or frolicky. There were fires on the field, real mayhem, real anarchic, you know. And my dad said, you know, like, these people have lost their minds. And we were Sox fans. He would take us to games. And it questioned whether or not you would be able to return to the ballpark after something like that. Obviously, we did, but it was still a moment where you said, like, what is this about? And it felt very directed and pointed at not only Black music, but Black people. All the signs pointed to that it was bigger than the music, right? There was some sort of unspoken language or communication around it. So the sign may have said disco sucks, but it meant, you know, gay music sucks or Black music sucks. And so, you know, people talk about dog whistles. It had that sort of feeling to it, that it wasn't just about the music. And in factual evidence points to that when people were asked at that time, like, what don't you like about disco music? Most men that were surveyed said, well, it's music for gays. And so it was threatening to their sexuality.
Yes. Interesting. You ended up creating your own event in response to this rhetoric. It was called Disco's Revenge. Talk about committing yourself to keeping disco alive and thriving as a genre.
So when the book came out that Dave Hoekstra and Steve Dahl wrote.
Which was also called Disco Demolition.
Which was also called Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. That was a sort of a call to me to present something that was actually not anti the book, but anti the sentiment around disco demolition. And because I am in the house community, I know the roots of house come from disco. And Frankie Knuckles actually popularized that statement that, you know, house music is disco's revenge. And I just thought this would pay homage to Frankie, but also reclaim what disco means to the house music community.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the ownership of Arbea, which is one of the local lounges here in Streeterville and in River North, they allowed me to, you know, come in on a weekly basis and, you know, do a disco thing. So with, you know, guest DJs, Javon Jackson and several other people who came by to pay homage to disco, you know, what's your version of disco and what do you like to play? And,
yeah.
And so we did that for a few years and really helped, you know, establish that club in a way that, and it's still surviving, but this was in 2016, so, and it's still going strong. They actually expanded, so I would like to say that Disco's Revenge put, you know, Arbea on the map in some ways. It really helped establish them as a local scene for nightlife.
I'm grateful for your efforts to make sure disco was never demolished.
Exactly.
Yes.
They tried.
Yeah. Tell me about kind of your entrance into DJing as a, you know, young, a grown person, as a person who's like, this is what I do. You know, how did you decide, you know, this is the work that I want to do for my life?
Yeah, money. Money money made me decide. To be honest, I was searching. And
okay.
I had gone to medical school for 2 years. I'd taken a year off. In that year, I discovered a lot of things about myself. One was that I really did appreciate house music and that it helped me get through a time when I was searching for what was going to be right for me.
Wow.
When I started dating a DJ, it just became clear, right? I had this equipment in my house and I was like, oh, yes, I've always loved this stuff. And I'd forgotten that when I was in high school, I used to hang out with all the DJs in my high school. And I had learned how to DJ in high school, had never done anything with it, kind of buried it, actually forgot about it, went to college, did 2 years of, you know, grad school, and then just, I forgot, I can do this. And so it was a light bulb moment. It was a light bulb moment.
Yeah.
And kind of played around in our apartment, in our house, and for a couple of years before you know, people would come over, we were entertained. And when everybody else got tired of spinning, they say, go spin, D. And so I would play and people were like, oh my God, you are good. and it was that sort of moment where people, I had a friend who was booking a shoe store where it was a real funky shoe store. All the club kids used to go get their shoes, their big platforms, and go to clubs like Shelter. And she put me in their space on a Saturday when it was really crowded. A lot of local promoters came down and saw me. And then it was after that, it was all she wrote. And when people started offering me money for it, I realized that it was a viable career, not just an avocation or not just a hobby. It was something I could do really for and make a living at it.
You have this song called FK Always, which is a tribute to Frankie Knuckles. Tell me about working with him. What did you love?
Oh, Frankie was a gentle spirit. He was so classy and sophisticated. And he just had a way about him. He was actually really in touch with all of his energies, right? So he could be masculine, he could be feminine, he could be, he was like all of that in one.
Wow.
He was just a great person, really somebody that you thought about emulating and in style. And he was always crispy clean with his appearance, you know, so fresh and so clean. and for me, it was somebody that I said, you know, he epitomizes what being a successful DJ is.
How so?
He always looked the part. He always played the part. You know, parties can be fun and you can get all sweaty and stuff and stuff like that. But Frankie went out looking the same way he went in. And I always found
that
to be,
off?
I know, listen, right?
I can't imagine being a DJ and not dancing the whole
because
time
because
well.
His movements were so precise.
Okay.
His precision, his accuracy. You know, when Ralphie Rosario produced that song, who's, you know, also really, really close with Frankie. Mm. And so when Frankie passed, you know, Ralphie had said, I have some original recordings of Frankie talking, and I have this concept for, you know, a song that sort of pays tribute to Frankie. And I was thinking about you a lot, and I wanted you to maybe do a little spoken word about it. And so he said, I'm also going to include some of the words of Frankie. And so when he let me hear what Frankie was saying, I sat down and wrote some simple things and, you know, went to the studio with him and sort of wrote what that meant to me. And and basically it just said, you know, be who you are and let, you know, the career and life and legacy of somebody like a Frankie Knuckles inspire you.
If you've got some kind of focus, that's the thing that saves your life. And the thing that saves your life is the thing that you should always concentrate on.
To be on such a heavy-hitting project was really cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah.
I'd rather be tucked away in a corner somewhere and feeding you what I've got, take it or leave it. I'm just really feeling this, and I'm just, like, really caught up in it.
And to be paying tribute to someone who has had such an immense impact.
Yeah, had such an immense impact and actually gave me a lot of validation. When Frankie booked me for his, you know, inaugural house music festival as the only woman DJ, that was validation for me.
Yeah. Speaking of being a woman DJ, how was it for you entering this profession? Where at the time so few women were being represented.
Yeah, at the time when I entered the profession, I would say that it was a tightrope, right? If you were seen as not taking it seriously, then you probably did not get the support from, you know, what is essentially a boys' club. But when I came in, I think that not only did I have the support of the guys who were already in the space, not only did they support me, but they really mentored me. But I also had some good role models, too, that were women. Terry Bristol and Psycho B were hands down running Chicago, some of Chicago's biggest clubs.
Wow.
And so a friendship was born from them, you know, being also welcoming,
yeah,
and not saying, oh, or feeling threatened by another woman coming into the space, right? I was very encouraged by both men, both women, and non-binary people who were all, you know, for expanding the representation of women in this field.
Yeah. What do you find are the most common misconceptions people have about disco, about house, about your work?
I think that it's so new for some people that they really do think disco died. If you grew up listening to mainstream radio, you didn't really hear disco after 1981, maybe, and you didn't hear house music on the radio at all. It doesn't pain me to say it, but it probably pains people to hear that Beyoncé, with her Renaissance album, put house music in the lexicon of people's worlds, of
That's
the mainstream
world. That's a little painful
world.
For me, I have to say, because, I mean, you know, coming from the home of techno and, mm-hmm. like, all of that, I mean, it is. But in a way, you're right. Yeah.
Nobody in the mainstream was talking about house music before Renaissance. I'm so sorry to... I'm so sorry. You know, except for the people who live the community.
Let's talk about Wicker Park Fest. So you are part of the lineup for this year's South Stage, which WBEZ is curating and producing. Do you remember spending much time in Wicker Park growing up?
I spent so much time in Wicker Park.
Okay.
Let
what
me
was
tell
it like?
You.
Yes, tell me about
all
it.
All the DJs that were popular at the time used to play. They would have these parties, and they were pretty run down, but they would find a way to put a, you know, a sound system in there.
Yes.
You know, put some art installations and some decor.
Oh, this is giving early electronic
yes.
scene heart.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
You know, between the house parties, the hip hop parties. But it was a very mixed scene. It was, you know, we were coming into a predominantly Puerto Rican and Polish neighborhood.
Okay.
Before it became what you know, what you see as Wicker Park today, it was a very vibrant, artistic, creative space to be in. You know, Common would be walking down the street with his notepad, and you know, that later that night there'd be an open mic in the speakeasy section of Literary Explosion, which
wow.
was an Afrocentric bookstore
Ooh.
On the corner of North and Damon in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. It was just a vibrant, colorful, dare I say, sexy time in yeah. the city's
and
life.
A little DIY, it sounds like.
Very DIY.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, you signed your song, A Deep Felt Love, to Defected Records. Congratulations.
Thank
by the
you.
Way. You're waxing poetic on this track as well.
Yes.
You repeat the words,
I am house.
I am house.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about what you want this record to convey.
I try to create metaphors around
yeah.
how house makes you feel, how deeply important it is to a certain community of folks. It is a deep felt love. It's as deep as any other, like, maybe addiction, but it's a good addiction.
I run so deeply within your veins that each time you leave me, you return.
It's an addiction that lifts you up so that you can, you know, live to see another day. A lot of people will say that music is medicine, but I say house music has a little extra something in it for you. And it's something for your mind, your body, and your soul. And that is really what house music does for me. This is how I feel about it.
Yeah. DJ Lady D is a celebrated DJ and producer and the owner of the Delectable Music label. Her work spans decades, genres. I'm so happy you're here with us. DJ Lady D, thank you.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to see everybody at the Wicker Park Fest.
Hey. WBEZ is a programming partner of Wicker Park Fest. And that's it for today. Justin Bull and I produced this episode of The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve is our editor and executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening.